God, when asked to show his essence, proclaimed to Moses, "No man will see me and be able to remain alive." When the children of Israel thought they were going to see God, or that they had seen him or some angel, they were afraid of dying. We read of this in Exodus, where they fearfully exclaimed, "May God not openly communicate himself to us, lest we die." Exodus 20:19. In the book of Judges, we read too that Munu, Samson's father, thinking that he and his wife had seen, in its essence, the angel that had appeared to them as a most handsome man, declared to his wife, "We shall die because we have seen the Lord." Judges 13:22. These visions do not occur in this life unless in some rare case and in a transient way. In such an instance, through a dispensation of the natural law, God preserves the nature and life of the individual. Abstracts the spirit entirely, and by his own power supplies the natural functions of the soul toward the body. When, as is the opinion, St. Paul saw them, the separated substances in the third heaven, he accordingly declared that he was carried up to them, and that he does not know whether he saw while in the body or out of the body, that God knows. 2 Corinthians 12, 2-4. Manifestly, he was transported above the ways of our natural life through the intervention of God. Also, when God, as is believed, revealed his essence to Moses, he declared that he would place Moses in the cleft of the rock and protect him from death at the passing of the divine glory by covering him with his right hand. This passing indicates both God's transient manifestation of himself and the concomitant preservation with his right hand of the natural life of Moses. Exodus 33:22. Such substantial visions as those of St. Paul, Moses, and our father Elias, when he covered his face at the whistling of the gentle breeze of God in 3 Kings 19:13, even though transitory, occur rarely or hardly ever, and to only a few. For God imparts this kind of vision only to those who are very strong in the spirit of the church and God's love, as were these three. Though these spiritual substances cannot be unclothed and seen clearly in this life by the intellect, they can nonetheless be felt in the substance of the soul by the most delightful touches and conjunctions. These pertain to the category of spiritual feelings, which, with God's help, we shall discuss later. For we are directing and guiding our pen toward these, that is, to the divine conjunction and union of the soul with the divine substance. We shall speak about this when dealing with the vague or dark mystical knowledge yet to be expounded, and treating of how, by means of this loving and obscure knowledge, God joins himself to the soul in a high and divine degree. In a way, this dark loving knowledge, which is faith, serves as a means for the divine union in this life and as the light of glory for the clear vision of God in the next. Let us discuss now the visions of corporeal substances received spiritually in the soul in a way similar to that of bodily visions. As the eyes behold corporeal objects by means of the natural light, so the intellect, through a supernatural light, as we said, sees interiorly these same objects and others too, according to God's wishes. The difference between the two kinds of vision lies in the mode and the manner. The spiritual and intellectual visions are far clearer and more delicate than the corporeal ones. For when God desires to bestow this favor upon a soul, he communicates that supernatural light we mentioned, so that through it the soul may behold with greater facility and clarity the earthly and heavenly objects he desires it to see. The absence or presence of these objects, then, is of no importance, nor does it hinder the vision. To get some idea of this phenomena, suppose that a door were opened so that the soul could see as it would if a flash of lightning were to illumine the dark night and momentarily make objects clearly and distinctly visible, only to leave them all in darkness again. Though the forms and the images of these objects would remain in the fantasy, this illumination takes place for more perfectly in the soul, for the objects seen in that light are so impressed on it that as often as it adverts to them, it beholds them as it did before. Just as the forms reflected in a mirror are seen as often as one looks in it, those objects of its vision are impressed on it so strongly that they are never entirely removed, although in the course of time they do become somewhat more remote. The effects these visions produce in the soul are quietude, illumination, gladness resembling that of glory, delight, purity, love, humility, and an elevation and inclination toward God. Sometimes these effects are more intense, sometimes less. Sometimes one effect predominates, at other times another. This diversity is due to the spirit that receives them and to God's wishes. Through spiritual suggestion and by means of a certain natural light, the devil can also cause these visions in the soul, whether the objects be present or absent. That account in St. Matthew which tells of the devil showing Christ all the kingdoms of the world and their glory, Matthew 4:8, is explained by some doctors as an example of spiritual suggestion by the devil, because it would have been impossible for him to make Christ see with his bodily eyes all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. A great difference lies between diabolical and divine visions, for the effects of diabolical visions are unlike those produced by the divine. The devil's visions produce spiritual dryness in one's communion with God and an inclination to self-esteem, to admitting them and to considering them important. In no way do they cause the mildness of humility and the love of God. Neither are the forms of these diabolical visions impressed with a delicate clarity upon the soul, as are the others. These impressed forms are not lasting, but are soon obliterated from the soul, except when its esteem causes a natural remembrance of them. But the memory of them is considerably arid and unproductive of the love and humility caused by the remembrance of the good visions. These visions cannot serve the intellect as a proximate means for union with God, because they deal with creatures that bear no portion or essential conformity to God. Consequently, to advance by the proximate means, which is faith, a person should behave in a purely negative way regarding them, as we have said. A person should not store up or treasure the forms of these visions impressed within him, neither should he have the desire of clinging to them. In doing so, he would impede himself by what dwells within him. Those forms, images, and figures of persons, and he would not journey to God through the negation of all things. Though these forms remain impressed within his soul, they are not a great impediment if he is unwilling to pay heed to them. Even if the remembrance of these visions really does stir the soul to some contemplation and love of God, denundation, pure faith, and darkness regarding them will stir and elevate it much more, and without its knowing how or whence this elevation comes. It will happen that a person will be enkindled with anxieties of very pure love without cognizance of their origin or foundation. The reason for this is that just as faith is infused and rooted more deeply in the soul by means of that emptiness, darkness, and nakedness regarding all things, or by that spiritual poverty, which are all the same, so too the charity of God is simultaneously infused and deeply rooted in the soul. The more one desires darkness and annihilation of himself regarding all visions, exteriorly and interiorly receivable, the more one desires darkness and annihilation of himself regarding all visions, exteriorly and interiorly receivable, the greater will be the infusion of faith, and consequently of love and hope, since these three theological virtues increase together. But a person does not always grasp or feel this love, because it does not reside with tenderness in the senses, but in the soul, with properties of strength and of greater courage and daring than before. Though at times it overflows into the senses, imparting a gentle, tender feeling. Accordingly, to attain that love, happiness, and joy caused and produced in the soul by these visions, a person should possess fortitude, mortification, and love, so as to remain in emptiness and darkness regarding all creatures, and he should base his love and joy upon what he neither sees nor feels. nor is capable of seeing or feeling, that is, upon God who is incomprehensible and transcendent. This is why our journey toward God must proceed through the negation of all. Even if a person is so shrewd and humble and strong that the devil is unable to deceive him by these visions or make him, as he usually does, fall into any presumption, the visions will be an obstacle to his advancement if he fails to practice this denial, since they impede spiritual nudity, poverty, and emptiness in faith, the requisite for union with God. Since the same doctrine that we taught about supernatural sensory visions and apprehensions in chapter 19 and 20 is valid also for these visions, we shall not waste any more time here in their discussion. Chapter 25 of Book 2. Logically, our next discussion should deal with the second kind of spiritual apprehensions, which are termed revelations and belong, properly speaking, to the spirit of prophecy. First, it should be understood that a revelation is nothing else than the disclosure of some hidden truth or the manifestation of some secret or mystery, as when God imparts understanding of some truth to the intellect, or discloses one of his past, present, or future deeds. We can affirm, therefore, the existence of two kinds of revelation. First, the disclosure of truth to the intellect. These are properly called intellectual notions or concepts. Second, the manifestation of secrets. The term revelation is more properly applied to this latter than to the former. The first kind cannot, strictly speaking, be called revelations, since in them God bestows clear and manifest understanding of naked truths concerning not only temporal but also spiritual objects. I desire to discuss these under the heading of revelations because of their close alliance and affinity with them, and to avoid a multiplication of divisions. As a result, we can divide revelations into two classes of apprehensions. The one we shall call intellectual knowledge, and the other, God's secrets and hidden mysteries. Beginning with the intellectual knowledge, we shall deal with these as briefly as possible in the following two chapters. Chapter 26 of Book 2. For an adequate exposition of this subject, the knowledge of naked truths, God would have to move my hand and pen. For you should know, beloved reader, that what they in themselves are for the soul is beyond words. Since, however, I intentionally speak of these only so as to impart instruction and guide the soul through them to the divine union, let me discuss them in a brief and restricted way, which will be sufficient for our purpose. This kind of vision, knowledge of naked truths, is far different from the kind we dealt with in chapter 24. This intellectual vision is not like the vision of corporeal objects, but rather refers to an intellectual understanding or vision of truths about God or to a vision of present, past, or future events, which bears great resemblance to the spirit of prophecy, as we shall perhaps explain later. This type of knowledge is divided into two kinds. The object of the one kind is the creator, and that of the other is the creature, as we said. Both kinds bring intense delight to the soul, yet those of God produce as incomparable delight. There are no words or terms to describe them, for they occasion knowledge and delight of God Himself. And as David says, there is nothing like unto Him. Psalm 39. God is the direct object of this knowledge, in that one of His attributes, His omnipotence, fortitude, and goodness and sweetness, is sublimely experienced. And as often as this experience occurs, it remains fixed in the soul. Since this communication is pure contemplation, the soul clearly understands that it is ineffable. A person is capable of describing it only through general expressions, expressions caused by the abundance and delight of these experiences, but he realizes the impossibility of explaining with these expressions what he tasted and felt in this communication. David, after receiving a similar experience, spoke in these unprecise and general terms. God's judgments, the virtues and attributes we experience in God, are true, in themselves justified, more desirable than gold, an extremely precious stone, and sweeter than honey and the honeycomb. Psalm 18.